Hello, I'm Alan Stanford, and welcome to Macbeth in Monaghan.
When shall we three meet again? In thunder, lightning, or in rain?
Go, get him, Turtle! Long save the king! The victory fell on us!
What he hath lost, noble Macbeth hath won!
Like a desert needs rain, like a town needs a name, I need your love.
Look, what I have, show me!
Like a drift in its rain,
Macbeth!
I need your love.
That shall be king hereafter.
Stay! You're a perfect speaker. Tell me more.
I need you.
What? Can the devil speak true?
Come, you spirits. Attend on mortal thoughts.
Duncan comes here tonight.
Like a rhythm unbroken, like drums in the night.
Hark!
Like sweet soul music, like sunlight. Need your love.
Bring forth men, Shimmerer.
Coming home, and you don't know where you've been.
This is a sunny sight.
Like nicotine, I need your love.
Macbeth does murder sleep! Macbeth shall sleep the mob!
A little water clears us of this need.
Wake Duncan with thy knocking!
Hello and welcome to St. Louis Secondary School, Carrickmacross in County Monaghan, our host school for this radio presentation of Macbeth. And I'd also like to welcome three other Monaghan schools who are participating in the broadcast, Monaghan Collegiate School, Patrician High School, and St. McCartan's College. Now, Macbeth is probably the most performed and by many considered the best of Shakespeare's plays for a variety of reasons. It's a very direct story. It's a very exciting story. It's almost like an adventure story or a whodunit murder mystery. It also is a play with no subplot. It's incredibly direct. There's no second storyline weaving its way through, which you find with most of Shakespeare's plays. And it's a play about blood. It's about people wading in blood. It's about murder. It's about death. It's about mayhem. It's about assassination. It's about politics. It's about betrayal. It's about mass murder. It's all in there. It's absolutely gorgeous. It's like a modern-day chaotic film. It's an Armageddon of a play. It divides itself very easily into five sections. And over the course of the four programs, we're going to look at each of these sections. The five of them I've always described as the prophecy, the murder, the betrayal, the genocide, and the revenge. In other words, Shakespeare takes us through a whole cycle of activity that starts with a single idea in somebody's mind and ends up almost destroying an entire nation until eventually the revenge of those victims takes over. And you can find parallels of that in the newspapers today. Countries and places where one person, one megalomaniac, suddenly decides, I want to run the world. And he will destroy, trample, create mayhem in order to fulfill his own ambition. And it's happened constantly through history. So Shakespeare was really writing a play about the kind of thing that is constantly repeating itself throughout the whole of human history and is still happening today. Now, onto the programme. Today's the first of the four programme. We're going to cover principally Acts 1 and 2 of the play, which I'm describing for the purpose of the exercise as the prophecy and the murder. And to help us to do that, we begin with some students from St. Louis and St. McCartan's. So let's begin with Act One.
When shall we three meet again? In thunder, lightning, or in rain?
When the hurly-burly's done, when the battle's lost.
And won.
That'll be ere the set of sun.
Where the place?
Upon the heat. There to meet with
Macbeth. Fair as foul and foul as fair, hover through the fog and filthy air.
The characters that define the play most are the witches. Shakespeare describes them as black and midnight hags. They don't really look quite like anything on earth. There's a reason for this. Now, to the audience that Shakespeare was writing for, witches were very much a reality. People believed in them. In fact, in the time of James I, when Shakespeare was writing, plenty of old women with beards were being burnt, hanged, and drowned with frightening regularity, and the appearance on stage of such creatures would have been accepted with respect and if not with fear, by the audience. The witch was something you believed in. The witch was somebody who could quite easily put a curse on you, do damage to you, or if you wanted, could do you a favor if you paid them enough. But they were dangerous, they were feared, they were illegal, and they were hung, drowned, and burnt. So in Shakespeare's time, the witches were real. But Shakespeare had an even deeper knowledge of theater form than just conventional superstition. He understood the rules of theater that were laid down 2,000 years before him by the Greeks. And the Greeks established the very principle of tragic form. Shakespeare's creation lived just as any other Greek tragic hero might have done, a man with a fatal flaw, somebody who could have been great but for the fact that something inside him rotted him. And in Macbeth's case, it's ambition. Like any Greek hero of old, he's informed by fate of his future path. In Greek theater, the Furies, the Fates, the Oracles, or whatever you want to call them, will inform the hero of what is going to happen. In this case, it is the witches, something that the audience could believe in, that they had supernatural powers, that they could predict the future. These witches will inform Macbeth of the future, and they will always, and this is terribly important to note in this play, they will always tell him the truth. The problem is, as we'll discover later on, he just doesn't listen to exactly what they're saying. He believes what he wants to hear. So thank you to Emma McMahon and McCormack and Grania McMahon from St. Louis as the witches.
I'm Mark Patrick Hederman from Glenstall Abbey, and I'm talking to you about witchcraft in Macbeth. It seems to me that Macbeth was really a very clever ploy by Shakespeare to find which play would be really marketable. And so he used the witchcraft in the play because he knew that King James I, who had just come to the throne, had written a book on demonology and was almost obsessionally interested in witches. The play, therefore, is about Scotland, which was flavour of the month, about witchcraft, and within that framework, Shakespeare was able to produce one of the most incredible tragedies that have ever been written.
My name is Alan Kearns, and I'm a six-year student in Belvedere College. The quote I chose was from the soliloquy when Macbeth just found out that his wife has died, and this is the final line in that soliloquy. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. I feel that these cold and distant words seem to chime the death of Macbeth as the character who we once knew in the early scenes. He seems to show no remorse or no emotion towards the fact that his wife, his partner in greatness, has passed on, has died. As Macbeth, as a new king, as a monarch, this attitude would seem extremely callous to even the most austere of monarchs. Macbeth, he's the shadow of who he used to know. He's a hollow shell. He was a loving husband, and he gave everything, including his morals, for his beloved wife. It's a very cynical soliloquy, and it gives a bitter account of the tedious and trivial nature and existence of humanity. And the fact that it's so malicious and the sentiments expressed are so deeply pessimistic would suggest that it's not nearly just a tirade on humanity or life in general, but it's more of a sardonic self-loathing rant on Macbeth and the monster who he's become himself. It's nearly that, a self-realisation. He seems to say that death's not important because it comes to it all, so when it comes, it makes no difference. When he says something as so callous as this, it seemed to nod our feelings and our nerves, because we know that this is not the spirit of Macbeth, that he is a kind person. He had the huge moral struggle over the killing of Duncan. He was Valor's minion, and he isn't the dead butcher, as Malcolm, I believe, calls him at the end of the play. each day of his life has lighted fools the dusty way to death, but in their final moments of realisation, as their doom has taken hold, Macbeth's desolate epiphany, he seems to say that no matter how glorious or how despicable our deeds have been, we are truly alone, because when we come to the end of our days, when the last syllable of recorded time is drawn to a close, it makes no difference, because when we take our bow, it is two empty seats.
Hi, I'm Allegra Fitzherbert from Newtown School. The scene I think is really interesting is the porter scene, but after the porter leaves, when Macbeth enters and talks with Macduff and Lennox, and they talk about the night and how it was stormy and stuff, and Macbeth is sort of hiding that he killed a king and had to agree and say, yes, it was a rough night, knowing that he's done this awful thing and these men are just making small talk. And then when Lennox asks, goes the king hence today, Macbeth sort of, he would hesitate, and he says he does, and then he did at points, so he kind of is very gripping because he's kind of hiding him. I think Lady Macbeth really stands out for me because, well, I think at the end she kind of makes a grand exit with her sleepwalking scene and she's going through this mental turmoil. Also Macduff, because he can go two ways on him. With his family, he lets them be murdered, but he's saving his country. It's just two big things he's had to decide between.
My name is Liam O'Shaughnessy. I'm a student in St. Colman's Community College in Middleton. I'm going to read a quote from Macbeth that comes from Act 2, Scene 1. Is this a dagger which I see before me? The handle toward my hand? Come, let me clutch thee. I have thee not, and yet I still see thee. Art thou, fatal vision, sensible, defiling as the sight? Or art thou but a dagger of the mind, a false creation, proceeding from the heat-oppressed brain? I see thee yet, in form as palpable, as this which now I draw. Thou marshals me the way that I was going, and such an instrument I was to use. I like this piece because it shows Macbeth debating about the murder of Duncan. He is still undecided at this point. It is almost as if the dagger is teasing him. It is a manifestation of Macbeth's hidden desire. He secretly wants to murder Duncan, yet he still cannot bring himself to do it at this point.
So we first meet Macbeth, our hero and villain, as he and Banquo, his closest friend, when they're returning from a savage battle. We learn our first lesson concerning our hero.
So foul and fair a day I have not seen.
How far is called to far is, but are these so withered and so wild in their attire, that look not like the inhabitants of the earth, and yet are on it? Live you, are you aught that man may question?
Speak, if you can, what are you?
All hail Macbeth, hail to thee, Thane of Glamis.
All hail Macbeth, hail to thee, Thane of Cawdor.
All hail Macbeth, thou shalt be king hereafter.
Good sir, why do you start, and seem to fear things that do sound so fair? In the name of truth, are ye fantastical, or that indeed which outwardly ye show? My noble partner, you greet with present grace and great prediction, of noble having and of royal hope.
Of noble having and of royal hope. The prediction is that he is noble, that he will be more noble, and that he has hope of the crown. He is Thane of Glamis, he will be Thane of Cawdor, and he will be king.
To me you speak not. If you can look into the seeds of time, and say which grain will grow and which will not, speak then to me, who neither beg nor fear, your favours nor your hate.
If you can look into the seeds of time, if you can see the future, tell me mine. Banquo wants to know as well. It's too tempting. If somebody could really tell you who's going to win next week's lotto, you'd want to know. If somebody tells your closest friend he's going to be king, well, what happens to me? It's a perfectly natural human reaction, and Banquo will die because of that reaction.
Hail.
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 Lesser than Macbeth and greater.
Not so happy, yet much happier.
Thou shalt get kings, though there be none.
So all hail, Macbeth and Banquo.
Banquo and Macbeth, all hail.
And that was Kieran Friel, Vincent McConnon from St. McCartan's, reading Banquo and Macbeth, and Claire Fay, Niamh Ruddy, and Karen Melia from St. Louis as the witches.
I'm Ben Haythornthwaite from Newtown School, and my favourite part in the play would probably be where Banquo returns as a ghost, because it sort of shows that Macbeth is, it's all catching up with him, and it's starting to take its toll on his sanity. And I like the quote, "Thou canst not say I did it," because it shows that he's lying to himself about all the bad things that he's done.
My name is Cleena Neely, and I'm a sixth-year student in St. Sabina Sutton. My favourite role in the play Macbeth is the role the witches play. Since they speak the first words we hear, and since they are the authors of the paradox the play constantly returns to, fair is foul and foul is fair, the witches are very clearly important elements. They seem to me to exist to the side of the action, as spectators, commentators, and distant influences. They are the forces of destruction and of vindictiveness. They do not have the power to change the course of events, they only have the ability to raise a storm. This storm, of course, is within Macbeth, although its raging has terrible consequences for others. The witches to me do not seem human, but partly supernatural. Look not like the inhabitants of the earth and yet are on it, as Banquo says. It is Banquo's responses and descriptions which helps us as an audience to interpret the witches. Macbeth is one we cannot trust. We see that he is strangely seduced by the three hags. He is rapt, as Banquo says. But we know that Macbeth is seduced by their prediction that he will become king. This is the important point. From this, they represent his ambition, his thoughts, and his private fantasies. But these witches are ugly, disgusting, and evil. Therefore, his ambition is ugly, disgusting, and evil. Just as the witches are part human, part supernatural, I can clearly see Macbeth as part loyal general, part traitor, part friend, part murderer. Fair is foul and foul is fair. The play suggests that humans can go one way or the other. If the witches represent the evil potential that is in all of us, then they can be resisted or else they can be acted upon. This is the central point of the witches.
My name is Siobhan O'Neill. I am a student of St. Colman's Community College, Middleton. This is a quote from Lady Macbeth. Hie thee hither, that I may pour my spirits in thine ear, and chastise with the valour of my tongue all that impedes thee from the golden round, which fate and metaphysical aid doth seem to have thee crowned. I pick this quote because it gives us an insight into Lady Macbeth's character. We see that Lady Macbeth is willing to kill Duncan in order for Macbeth to become king, but also that she acknowledges that Macbeth would have to be talked into it. Her ruthless ambition here overrides her morals as she doesn't consider whether killing Duncan is right or wrong.
Within moments of the witches vanishing into the air, Ross arrives with the news.
The king hath happily received, Macbeth, the news of thy success. And when he reads thy personal adventure in the rebels' fight, his wonders and his praises do contend which should be thine or his. And, for an earnest of a greater honour, he bade me, from him, call thee Thane of Cawdor, in which addition, hail most worthy Thane, for it is thine.
So in other words, within seconds, the witch's first prediction has come true. Hail to thee, Thane of Cawdor.
What? Can the devil speak true?
The Thane of Cawdor lives. Why do you dress me in borrowed robes?
Who was the Thane lives yet, but under heavy judgment bears that life which he deserves to lose. For treasonous capital confessed and proved have overthrown him.
Glamis and Thane of Cawdor, the greatest is behind. Do you not hope your children shall be kings, when those that gave the Thane of Cawdor to me promised no less to them?
That trust at home might yet enkindle you unto the crown. Besides Thane of Cawdor, but to strange, and oftentimes to win us to our harm. The instruments of darkness tell us truths, win us with honest trifles.
And Banquo at that moment is giving an absolutely clear perception of what the reality is. Sometimes the devil does speak true. Sometimes, to win you over, evil will give you what you want. And it does with Macbeth. But at this moment, he is now beginning to think that the crown could be his. He could be king.
This supernatural soliciting cannot be ill, cannot be good. If ill, why hath it given me earnest of success, commencing in a truth? I am Thane of Cawdor. If good, why do I yield to that suggestion, whose hard image doth infix my hair, and make my seated heart knock at my ribs, against the use of nature? Present fears are less than horrible imaginings. My thought, whose murder yet is but fantastical, shakes on my single state of man that function is smothered in surmise. Nothing is but what is not.
Enkindled within Macbeth is his ambition, but not yet a determination to do anything about it. In other words, it scares the hell out of him. I am Thane of Cawdor. If that's true, and if the prophecy is true, that I may become king, why do I yield to that suggestion whose horrid image doth unfix my hair and make my seated heart knock at my ribs? The whole idea scares the hell out of him. He's not ready to act on it just yet. He travels on to meet the king, Duncan. Now, of all the characters in the play, it would seem that the one with the least political acumen, the man least able to understand other people or to read them, is the king. The traitor Corder, the man who betrayed him and started this war against him, Duncan described as a gentleman on whom I built an absolute trust. The moment after he has told us what he thought of the original Thane of Corder, he meets Macbeth and addresses him immediately as worthiest cousin. Duncan is incapable of seeing below the surface of a man, of reading from the false face what the false heart does know. Duncan is overjoyed at the success of Macbeth, and he tells Macbeth that he's going to visit him in Glam's castle, Macbeth's home. But before he does so, he informs all his followers that he is electing his own son, Malcolm, Prince of Cumberland, to be his heir, to be the next king. If Malcolm is elected already to be the next king, how can the prophecy come true? The witches prophesied Macbeth will be king. The witches always tell the truth, so Macbeth's got a problem.
The Prince of Cumberland, that is a step on which I must fall down, or else or leap, for in my way it lies. Stars, hide your fires, let not light see my black and deep desires. The eye wink at the hand, yet let that be which the eye fears, when it is done, to see.
It's a short speech, but incredibly important. The realization, Prince of Cumberland, the way to the crown. That's a step on which I must fall down, or else all leap. Either I give up now, or I overcome this problem. He then calls on the stars to hide their fires. Let not light see my black and deep desires. He's calling on night. He's calling on darkness, because he knows that the only way to make the prophecy true is for him to do something that the eye would fear to look on, and that is to assassinate the king. We are moving from the prophecy to the murder. Thank you to Vincent McConnon as Macbeth, to Conor Gannon as Ross, and to Ciarán Friel as Banquo, all from St. McCartan's. And now Elaine Murphy of Patrician High School, Carrickmacross, is going to give you a sample answer to a question on Macbeth.
When responding to a question in relation to the theme of kingship in Shakespeare's Macbeth, it is essential to explore and examine the notion of sovereignty in medieval society. This can most effectively be done by studying each of the four representatives of kingship in the play. A king in medieval society was considered an agent for God on earth. The king was a symbol of all that was good and honourable. They were considered emblems of order, peace and harmony. The king personified the moral and social welfare of his subjects. The play presents us with four kings. Duncan, Edward and Malcolm symbolised justice and nobility, and Macbeth, who eventually epitomises the evil induced when kingship is obtained without divine authority. Shakespeare emphasises good versus evil to the audience, and how a desirable or immoral king can have either a constructive or detrimental effect on the country. Kingship is initially presented in the form of King Duncan. He is a trusting, generous and good-natured king. His reign, though, has not been totally successful. He has been too gullible and naive, Macbeth describes in Act 1, Scene 7. Duncan hath borne his faculties so meek. Treachery and insurgents have ensued in Scotland. Duncan is weak and therefore vulnerable. The death of Duncan is the death of order in Scotland and the onset of chaos, with Macbeth in power instigating disorder and unnatural occurrences throughout the state. Macbeth, fiend of Scotland, as Macduff surmises in Act 4, Scene 3, overpowers, usurps his cousin King Duncan. He takes the throne by bloody, violent means. Macbeth has committed a ruthless and the most callous crime of regicide. I have done the deed, Act 2, Scene 2. Subsequently, this evil and most sacrilegious murder is the catalyst for further malevolence, assassinations, and gruesome slaughtering. The crown itself is a symbol of Scotland's decline into mayhem, violence and terror. Once the valiant hero, Macbeth is now perceived as a tyrant, living in a world of corruption. It weeps, it bleeds, and each new day a gash is added to her wounds. Malcolm in Act 4, Scene 3 depicts this world vividly. A corrupt king has evidently resulted in a corrupt state, and Macduff also suspects in Act 4, Scene 3. Each new morn, new widows howl, new orphans cry. The third representative of kingship is King Edward of England, whom Malcolm has sought refuge. He is referred to by a lord in Act 3, Scene 6 as Pious Edward. He is similar to both Duncan and Malcolm, clearly representational of all that is virtuous and kindly in the play. His sovereignty is honourable, epitomised in Act 4, Scene 3 by Malcolm himself, and sundry blessings hang about his throne that speak him full of grace. King Edward was somewhat unique, as he was a healer, embodying for Shakespeare a medium of eradicating and overpowering immorality to destroy and rid illness and disease. Edward assists and provides aid to Malcolm in liberating Scotland of the malady that has manifested with Macbeth at its helm. Malcolm is rightful heir to the throne. He is aware of what personality and traits are required to be a good king, as he outlines in Act 4, Scene 3. The king becoming graces as justice, verity, temperance, stableness, bounty, perseverance, mercy, courage, lowliness, devotion, patience, courage, fortitude. He is determined and committed to overthrow Black Macbeth and restore Scotland to its former self. In concluding your exam answer, re-evaluate and assess once again question asked and points that you have previously discussed.
The first thing Macbeth does is to write to his wife. Very important thing to remember this. He loves his wife. She loves him. There is a great love affair in this play. They have no children. They only have each other. And they have ambition. Lady Macbeth, having heard the news, has plans for the future.
The raven himself is hoarse that croaks the fatal entrance of Duncan under my battlements. Come, ye spirits that tend on mortal thoughts, unsex me here and fill me from the crown to the toe top full of direst cruelty. Make thick my blood. Stop up the access and passage to remorse, that no compunctious visitings of nature shake my fell purpose, nor keep peace between the effect and it. Come to my woman's breasts, and take my milk for gall, you murdering ministers, wherever in your sightless substances you wait on nature's mischief.
She's literally saying, make a man of me. Don't let me have the tenderness and the softness and the vulnerability of a woman's sensibilities. Don't let me feel pity. Don't let me feel anything that a woman might feel. Make a man of me.
Come, thick knight, and pall thee in the dunnest smoke of hell, that my keen knife see not the wound it makes, nor heaven peep through the blanket of the dark to cry, hold, hold.
In this, she is summoning darkness as well, just as Macbeth did. Stars, hide your fires. Come, thick night, and pall thee in the dunnest smoke of hell. They know that what they're going to do needs to be done in the dark, because it is wrong, because it is immoral. It's a murder. Then Macbeth arrives.
Great Glamis, worthy Cawdor, greater than both, by the all hail hereafter. Thy letters have transported me beyond this ignorant present, and I feel now the future in the instant.
My dearest love, Duncan comes here tonight.
And when goes hence?
Tomorrow, as he purposes.
Oh, never shall sun that morrow see.
And there's the darkness again. Never shall sun that morrow see. For Duncan, there will only be the dark.
Your face, my thane, is as a book where men may read strange matters, to beguile the time, look like the time, bear welcome in your eye, your hand, your tongue, look like the innocent flower, but be the serpent under it.
Now, her big concern here is that Macbeth, even though he's ambitious, even though he's determined, will give it all away, because he's a man. And men tend to do that. A man's face tells what a man's thinking. And she is saying to him, hide those thoughts. Don't let your face show what you're thinking. To beguile the time, look like the time. The time is devious, be devious. The time is bright, be bright. Convince people that everything is okay, because that's the way we're going to win.
He that's coming must be provided for, and you shall put this night's great business into my dispatch, which shall to all our nights and days to come give solely sovereign sway and masterdom.
We will speak further.
Only look up clear. To alter favour ever is to fear. Leave all the rest to me.
He's still not sure. We'll speak further. I want to think about it. Don't push me. Don't rush me. And she said, no. Keep the one clear thought in your mind. To change your mind means that you're frightened. Don't be frightened. Leave it to me. She's a dreadful hostess. And that was Orla McMahon from St. Louis and Gareth Salmon from St. McCartan's as Macbeth and Lady Macbeth.
My name is Claire Dunn, and I'm a sixth-year student from Loretto College in Stephen's Green. And my favourite quote from Macbeth is, I am in blood steeped so far that should I wage no more, returning were as tedious as go over. The above quote really and truly exhibits the desensitising of Macbeth. He is no longer a man that has the freedom of choice and nobility as he once was when we first meet the noble Macbeth. Instead, he is metamorphosized into a ruthless tyrant who is infected by vaulting ambition and its bitter consequences. I feel that this quote epitomizes the tragic turn of fate awaiting Macbeth. Macbeth that evening had just seen the ghost of the newly murdered Banquo. Such a murder, of course, was instructed by Macbeth. In this scene, we are witness to the role reversal that occurs between the noble Macbeth and his dearest partner of greatness. Lady Macbeth loses her tight rein of control over her husband, whereas Macbeth begins to become wholly engulfed with his own private agenda and vaulting ambition. He had initiated the murder of Banquo, a ploy which I would assume displayed his need to impress his wife, to fulfil his manhood. And now he is paying the cost of his endeavours on his own. He is a man of pride and therefore refuses to seek support from his dearest chuck. This quote, I suppose, is as pivotal to the play as the scene which it is taken from. Macbeth decides that he will return to the witches and that he will place his trust, faith and goodwill in three androgynous instruments of darkness. It is here that he supports the metaphysical deception of evil. It proves his ambition and the ruthlessness of how far Macbeth would go to achieve. No longer does he trust himself nor Lady Macbeth to make decisions for him. Rather, he seeks advice and guidance from the illicit backstreet dealers in the form of the witches.
My name is Owen Devlin and I'm a sixth-year student in Belvedere College. My favourite quote from Shakespeare's Macbeth is from the final speech of Macbeth before he dies at the end of the play. Life's but a walking shadow. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. I chose this because it poetically shows how the character of Macbeth, who was once full of great ambition, has declined so rapidly into a being that no longer sees the point in living. What is fascinating about this quote is that it comes when Macbeth has achieved what the prophecy set out for him to do and what his ambitions outlined. Yet life, for him, still signifies nothing. I really admire his philosophical disposition and his use of poetic language in this scene.
Hello, my name is Alexandra Lowries and I'm a sixth-year student attending St. Colman's Community College. I've given suck and know how tender it is to love that babe that milks me. I would, while it was smiling in my face, have plucked my nipple from his boneless gums and dashed the brains out, had I so sworn as you have done to this. Lady Macbeth's ruthlessness, cruelty and manipulative nature is very evident from this quote. She will not let Macbeth pull out of killing Duncan and uses vivid imagery to convey just how far she would be willing to go if it was her who had made the promise to Macbeth. I find this quote very significant, for as we go on in the play, we see a drastic change in Lady Macbeth's ambitious nature and are later confronted by a mirror image of the formerly strong woman we meet at the beginning of the play.
So, the Macbeths go off to do a little plotting, and Duncan arrives. Everything is right with the world. Duncan meets his hostess.
See, your honoured hostess. The love that follows us sometimes is our trouble, which still we thank is love. Herein I teach you how you should bid God Ildus from your pains and thank us for your trouble.
All our service, in every point twice done and then done double, were poor and single business to contend against those honours deep and broad wherewith your majesty loads our house.
Fair and noble hostess, we are your guests tonight. Give me your hand, conduct me to mine host, we love him highly, and shall continue our graces towards him. By your leave, hostess.
This scene couldn't be nicer if it tried. There's Lady Macbeth saying, oh, it's so wonderful for you to come here. Oh, we love you so much, thank you so much, and you're such a wonderful person. And Duncan saying, no, you're the wonderful person, and I should be thanking you for all the trouble I've put you to, and where is my host, where's Macbeth, because I think so much of him, I want to go and see him again. So Shakespeare's giving you the impression that actually maybe everything is all right, that nasty things aren't going to happen. And it certainly makes Duncan feel very safe and secure in Macbeth's home. So we can assume that Duncan is now, having been fed and wined and wassailed, is now safely tucked up in bed, feeling that all is right with the world. And at this point, Lady Macbeth and her husband start to discuss putting their plan into effect. But Macbeth is beginning to have second thoughts. He believes that if the prophecy is true, the prophecy will come to pass. If they made him Thane of Cawdor, they will make him king without him doing anything. His wife wants to make sure. His wife wants to be sure. In this sequence of the play, it's almost that she is more manly than her husband. She's asked for that feminine weakness to be taken from her, and now it seems that it has. Macbeth has doubts.
We will proceed no further in this business. He hath honoured me of late, and I have bought golden opinions from all sorts of people, which would be worn now in their newest gloss, not cast aside so soon.
Was the hope drunk wherein you dressed yourself? Hath it slept since, and wakes it now to look so green and pale at what it did so freely? From this time, such I account thy love. Art thou afeard to be the same in thine own act and valour as thou art in desire? Wouldst thou have which thou esteem the ornament of life, and live a coward in thine own esteem, letting I dare not wait upon I would, like the poor cat idiotic?
Prithee, peace. I dare do all that may become a man. Who dares do more is none.
Now that's very interesting. She's calling him a coward. Letting I dare not wait upon I would. And that's exactly what Macbeth is doing. I want to be king. I've only got to kill him to become king. I want to do it. I'm afraid of doing it. I can't do it. Will I do it? And he's wavering, and she's getting very impatient with him.
What beast was it then that made you break this enterprise to me? When you durst do it, then you were a man. And to be more than what you were, you would be so much more than man.
To be more than what you were, to be more than just a man, you would be king.
I have given suck, and know how tender 'tis the love of the babe that milks me. I would, while it was smiling in my face, have plucked my nipple from his boneless gums and dashed the brains out, had I so sworn as you have done to this.
It's a very interesting point. They don't appear to have any children. Later on in the play, Macduff says he has no children. We can conjecture that at some point they may have had children. The child or the children may have died in infancy. That's not unusual. But what she's saying is, I have been a mother. I've had that tenderest of relationships between myself and a child feeding at my breast. I would have killed the child rather than behave the way you are now.
If we should fail?
We fail. But screw your courage to the sticking place and we'll not fail. When Duncan is asleep, where to the rather shall this day's hard journey soundly invite him? His two chamberlains, will I with wine and wassail so convince that memory, the water of the brain, shall be a fume, and the receipt of reason a limbic only. When in swanish sleep their drenched natures lie as in a death, what cannot you and I perform upon the unguarded Duncan? What not put upon his spongy officers, who shall bear the guilt of our great quell?
In other words, I'll get his guards drunk, we go and kill him, and then we blame the guards. Her plan is perfect. And that was Gareth Salmon from St. McCartan's as Macbeth and Natalie Duffy from St. Louis as Lady Macbeth. And now Tom Prendergast of Castle Troy College, Castle Troy, County Limerick, is going to give you a sample answer to a question on Macbeth.
Today I will be exploring the character of Macbeth and the impact Lady Macbeth has on this relationship. To examine Macbeth's character without also looking at Lady Macbeth's influence on him is akin to examining the character of John Lennon without reference to Yoko Ono, or indeed discussing Homer Simpson without acknowledging the role of Marge Simpson in Homer's life. Remember, Macbeth is a tragic hero, and it does exactly what it says on the tin. Brave Macbeth falls from grace because of a flaw in his character. When the audience first meet Macbeth, he is admired by all of Scotland because he vanquished MacDonald and the Norwegian king in battle. However, Macbeth's ambition to be king, allied to the witch's prophecy, plant a seed of desire within him. Macbeth's desire is fertilized by Lady Macbeth's insistence that he murder Duncan to attain his vaulting ambition. Prior to the murder of Duncan, the play is slowly moving towards the apex of a rollercoaster ride. And after Duncan's murder, the play hurtles us towards its tragic ending. So, how do you put a structure on all the knowledge and information you possess about Macbeth in approximately 55 minutes and within the confines of an exam hall? What you have to remember is that you will have much more information than you will ultimately need, so your answer will have to be the fillet, the best piece of all the information you possess. At no stage should you panic and merely summarise the play, regardless of what is being asked. Have faith in yourself. It is worth highlighting where the 60 marks for Macbeth go. 18 of those 60 marks are for purpose, which means answering the question that you have been asked. Another 18 marks are for clarity, whereby you try and sustain a well-structured answer throughout the course of your response to the question on Macbeth. Another 18 marks are available for your use of language, where this is your chance to show your flair. 6 marks are available for mechanics, which is your spelling, your grammar, and so forth. Further details can be accessed at www.examinations.ie. What we are looking at is a question that asks us to examine the character of Macbeth and the impact Lady Macbeth has on this relationship. 6 potential points that could be included are, firstly, Macbeth's ambition has been pricked by the witch's initial prophecy. Then you could go on to talk about the fact that Lady Macbeth fears that Macbeth may not have the courage to kill Duncan. She states this in her "Too Full of the Milk of Human Kindness" speech, which you could refer to in this paragraph. My third point would be, Lady Macbeth challenges Macbeth's courage and manhood with her violent and unnatural description of dashing out the brains of a child she was breastfeeding rather than breaking an oath. A fourth point you could include could be the weakening of their partnership with the murder of Banquo, which is unknown to Lady Macbeth, and later the murder of Macduff's family. A second last point could be the rising guilt in Lady Macbeth contrasts with the rising invincibility in Macbeth. Finally, then, you could discuss their respective deaths, where Lady Macbeth's descent into madness could be supported with her "out damn spot" speech, and indeed Macbeth's soliloquy on the transience of life, "life's but a walking shadow." These 6 points make up the various paragraphs which form the body of your answer. When writing the points and paragraphs, remember your topic sentence, which generally is the first sentence in the paragraph that almost gives the paragraph a title and tells the reader the purpose of this particular paragraph. I have deliberately omitted your introduction and conclusion. The necessity and importance of both cannot be overstated. It gives your answer its individuality, as it allows you to give the examiner a feel for your grasp of the subject. So, seize the day, be brave, and try to grab the reader's attention. The introduction and conclusion are often the polish that improves an answer. And also remember, the points you have developed in the body of your answer will be largely similar to other candidate scripts, so the importance of the introduction, and also the conclusion, is paramount. In conclusion, I would like to highlight common mistakes that many students often make. These mistakes include where the students misread the question in their eagerness to start answering. You must underline key phrases in the question and keep referring back to them so as to ensure you do not drift off the point when answering the question. Students often forget to write an introduction and launch into their answer, or indeed forget to write a conclusion and merely leave their answer unfinished. Another common mistake is where students overdevelop a single point to the detriment of others. It is much better to have 5 or 6 points developed in your answer rather than elaborating on only 2 or 3 points. Finally then, a lot of students seek safety in quotes. Be careful you do not overuse quotes. Be selective. Be accurate. Understand why the quote is important and why you like it. Indeed, if you listen to the selection of the students' favourite quotes in the series and their importance, this may provide some tips for you.
So, the plan is agreed. The murder is going to take place. It's going to happen. And Macbeth is going to do it. Shakespeare doesn't show the murder, but in 2 very brilliant scenes, he shows the moment before the murder and the effect it has on Macbeth and his wife after the murder is committed. Before this terrible act of regicide, the murder of a king, Macbeth sees a ghostly dagger pointing him the way to Duncan's room, urging him on to do it, but it's also showing to us what's going to happen. This dagger of the mind tells us what will occur in Duncan's room.
Is this a dagger which I see before me, the handle toward my hand? Come, let me clutch thee. I have thee not, and yet I see thee still. Art thou not fatal vision, sensible to feeling as to sight? Or art thou but a dagger of the mind, a false creation proceeding from the heat-oppressed brain? I see thee yet, in form as palpable as this which now I draw. Thou marshallest me the way that I was going, and such an instrument I was to use. Mine eyes are made the fools of the other senses, or else worth all the rest. I see thee still, and on thy blade and dudgeon, gouts of blood which was not so before.
And so the vision is becoming worse. He sees a dagger. Then he sees a dagger dripping with blood. This dagger of the mind telling him this is what's going to happen.
There's no such thing. It is the bloody business which informs thus to mine eyes. Now o'er the one half world, nature seems dead, and wicked dreams abuse the curtained sleep. Witchcraft celebrates pale Hecate's offerings.
And that's about darkness again. Half the world is in darkness, the half of the world in which he exists.
And withered murder, alarmed by his sentinel, the wolf, whose howls his watch, thus with his stealthy pace, with Tarquin's ravishing strides, towards his design moves like a ghost.
A very, very important passage, because Macbeth is almost turning murder itself into an entity. You can almost imagine this strange creature, murder, coming towards him.
Thou sure and firm set earth, hear not my steps which way they walk, for fear thy very stones prate of my whereabout, and take the present horror from the time which now suits with it. Whilst I threat, he lives, words to the heat of deeds too cold breath gives.
He admits to himself, I can talk about it and talk about it, but if I don't do something about it, nothing's going to happen. And then a bell rings.
I go, and it is done. The bell invites me. Hear it not, Duncan, for it is a knell that summons thee to heaven or to hell.
And thank you to Gareth Salmon for beautifully reading The Dagger Thief. And so, almost in a state of terror, Macbeth goes to kill Duncan. Lady Macbeth is waiting for him to come back. And in a way, she's just as frightened. It's actually very important, this. They're not monsters, they're human beings. These are ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances. And what Shakespeare is saying is, this could be you.
That which had made them drunk had made me bold. What had quenched them had given me fire. Hark! Peace. It was the owl that shrieked the fatal bellman, which gives the sternest good night. He is about it. The doors are open, and the surfeited grooms do mock their charge with snores. I have drugged their possets, that death and nature do contend about them, whether they live or die.
Who's there?
Alack, I am afraid they have awakened, and 'tis not done. The attempt and not the deed confounds us. Hark, I laid their daggers ready. He could not miss them. Hath he not resembled my father as he slept? I had done it.
And in this sequence, Shakespeare is showing us the humanity of Lady Macbeth. He's showing us her fear. She's saying, I've done this, I've done that, I put it all right, I prepared everything. Then she hears a noise. What? What is it? Oh, no, no, it's okay, it was only the owl, it's nothing, don't be frightened. Then, after the murder, Macbeth returns.
My husband.
I have done the deed. Didst thou not hear a noise?
I heard the owl scream and the crickets cry. Did not you speak?
When?
Now.
As I descended?
Aye.
Hark, who lies in the second chamber?
Donalbain.
And then he looks at his hands.
This is a sorry sight.
His hands are covered in Duncan's blood. And then he talks about frightening noises. He heard a voice shouting out.
There's one did laugh in his sleep, and one cried, murder, that they did wake each other. I stood and heard them, but they did say their prayers and address them again to sleep.
There are two lodged together.
One cried, God bless us, and amen, the other. As they had seen me with these hangman's hands, listening their fear, I could not say amen, when they did say, God bless us.
Consider it not so deeply.
But wherefore could not I pronounce amen? I had most need of blessing, and amen stuck in my throat. Methought I heard a voice cry, sleep no more, Macbeth does murder sleep. The innocent sleep, sleep that knits up the raveled sleeve of care, the death of each day's life, sore labour's bath, balm of hurt minds, great nature's second course, chief nourisher in life's feast.
What do you mean?
Still, it cried, sleep no more, to all the house. Glamis hath murdered sleep, and therefore Cawdor shall sleep no more. Macbeth shall sleep no more.
It's a terrible prophecy on himself. The realization that he will never sleep soundly in his bed again. It's an absolute declaration of the horror of what he's done. And again, he keeps bringing us back, not to Macbeth as a monster, but to Macbeth as an ordinary man who has done a monstrous thing. Shakespeare is saying to his audience, each and every one of you is capable of doing. And when you do it, you won't sleep sound again.
Infirm of purpose, give me the daggers. The sleeping and the dead are but as pictures. 'Tis the eye of childhood that fears a painted devil. If he do bleed, I'll gild the faces of the grooms with all, for it must seem their guilt.
Whence is that knocking? How is it with me when every noise appalls me? What hands are here? Ha, they pluck out mine eyes. Will all great Neptune's ocean wash this blood clean from my hand? No, this my hand will rather the multitudinous seas incarnadine, making the green one red.
Now that's a very interesting sequence, in the sense that Lady Macbeth proves herself to be infinitely more practical. It's the woman coming out in her again. It's that sense of, don't be stupid. All it is your own fear. The fear within yourself that let the dagger come into your mind. She's trying to shake him out of this deep-rooted fear that she can see could make him go and confess the murder straight away. That knocking at the door appalls him. Not for the fact that someone's knocking at the door, but for the amount of fear that it causes in him. The slightest noise almost makes his heart stop with fear. And again, the look at the blood on his hands. He'll never be able to wash that blood off. This man is very, very frightened. His wife comes back.
My hands are of your colour, but I shame to wear a heart so white. I hear knocking. A little water clears us off this deed. How easy it is, then. Your constancy had left you unattended. Hark, hark, more knocking. Get on your nightgown, lest occasion call us and show us to be watchers. Be not lost so poorly in your thoughts.
Wake, Duncan, with thy knocking. I would thou couldest.
That line tells you the degree of regret that Macbeth now feels for what he's done. It is deeply important. We have had the prophecy that said you will be king. We have seen him, in collusion with his wife, agree to the murder of the king and carry it out. And what it has done has not elevated or enriched Macbeth. It hasn't made him feel better. It's made him feel a hell of a lot worse. Thank you there to Sinead O'Connor as Lady Macbeth, Garrett Salmon as Macbeth, and the wonderful performance of Brian Boyle as the voice off. And in today's quiz, representing Louise, we have...
Linda Martin.
From Patrician, we have...
Sean Carlin.
From Collegiate...
Valer Fanicar.
And from St. McCartan's...
Tim O'Hanran.
And we begin with a question for each of you. Linda, who says, the Thane of Corder lives, why do you dress me in borrowed robes?
Macbeth.
Correct. That's 2 points. Sean, who says, there's no art to find the mind's construction in the face, he was a gentleman on whom I built an absolute trust?
Duncan.
Correct. Villa, who says, the raven himself is horse that croaks the fatal entrance of Duncan under my battlements?
Lady Macbeth.
Correct. And now Tim, who says, look like the innocent flower, but be the serpent under it?
Lady Macbeth.
Correct. So that's another 2 points. And at the moment, we've 2 points each. Well done. Round two. I'm going to play each of you a snippet from a recording of the play. Linda, this is your recording.
No more that Thane of Corder shall deceive others of interest. Go, pronounce his present death, and with his former title greet Macbeth.
I'll see it done.
What he has lost, noble Macbeth hath won.
Now, Linda, who's speaking for 1 point, and to whom for a 2 point?
Duncan to Ross.
Duncan is the principal speaker, and to Ross, yes, 2 points. Okay, Sean, this is your recording.
This is a sorry sight.
A foolish thought to say a sorry sight.
As one did laugh and sleep, and one cried murder, that they did wake each other. I stood and heard them, but they did say their prayers and addressed them again to sleep.
Who's speaking to whom?
That's Macbeth to Lady Macbeth.
That's correct. 2 points. Well done. Now, Villa.
What had he done to make him fly the land?
You must have patience, madam.
He had none. His flight was madness. When our actions do not, our fears do make us traitors.
You know not whether it was his wisdom or his fear.
Wisdom? To leave his wife, to leave his babes, his mansion and his titles in a place from whence himself does fly?
So who are the two people speaking in that scene?
Lady Macduff speaking to Ross.
Correct. Tim, here's yours.
My lord.
Thou comest to use thy tongue. Thy story, quickly.
Gracious, my lord. I should report that which I say I saw, but know not how to do it.
Well, say, sir.
As I did stand my watch upon the hill, I looked toward Burnham, and anon methought the wood began to move.
Who are the two speakers there?
Macbeth and a messenger.
Correct. Well done. 2 points. Tricky one, that. And now the quickfire round. So put your fingers on your buttons. Who is the King of Scotland at the opening of the play? Villa, yes?
Duncan.
Correct. There's a point. Can you name the two generals of the King's army? Yes, that's Sean.
That would be Banquo and Macbeth.
Correct. Where do the three witches plan to meet Macbeth? Linda?
Upon a heath.
On the heath, correct. What do the three witches predict for Banquo? That's Sean.
That he would be father to a line of kings.
That's right, his children will be kings. In Act 1, Scene 1, Ross reports to Duncan of Macbeth's victory against whom? That was very quick. That's Sean.
Norway.
Correct. At the beginning of the play, what title does Macbeth hold? That's Willem.
Thane of Glamis.
Thane of Glamis, correct. What title does Duncan confer on Macbeth for his services in battle? And that's Linda.
Cathal Corder.
Name Duncan's sons. That's Linda again, very quick.
Donald Ben and Malcolm.
Correct. What title does Duncan confer on Malcolm? Linda again, my goodness.
Prince of Cumberland.
Prince of Cumberland, yes. What does that signify? She's very quick.
Heir to the throne.
Heir to the throne, yes. Well done. Lady Macbeth receives a letter from her husband which tells her of his meeting with whom? Tim was in first.
The three weird sisters.
Correct. What's the name of Banquo's son? That's Sean.
Fleance.
Fleance is correct. Where is Macbeth's castle situated?
In Venice.
Correct. On hearing news of Duncan's imminent arrival, what does Lady Macbeth plan? Who is that? Tim.
To murder Duncan.
That's correct. To murder the king. When does Lady Macbeth say they should kill the king? Linda.
In his sleep.
In his sleep, yes. And at the end of the quiz, St. McCartan's have 6 points, Collegiate have 7, Patrician has 8, and St. Louis has 10. Our production crew today was Kevin Reynolds, Catherine Brennan, Sean Rocks, and Orla Cotta, with Tony Lyons on sound. And I'm Alan Stanford of Second Age Theatre Company. Join us next week when we examine the betrayal in Macbeth.
Like a desert needs rain, like a town needs a name, I need your love. Like a drifter needs a wind, hot moon, I need your love. I need you.